What is our goal going in? We had in our hemisphere a regime operated by an indicted narco trafficker that became a base of operation for virtually every competitor, adversary, and enemy in the world. It was, for Iran, their primary spot of operation in the Western Hemisphere. For Russia, their primary base of operation in the Western Hemisphere, along Cuba and Nicaragua, was Venezuela. In the case of China, China was receiving oil at a huge, about $20 a barrel discount. They weren't even paying money for it. It was being used to pay down debt that they were owed. This is the oil of the people of Venezuela, and it was being given to the Chinese as barter. And so you had basically three of our primary opponents in the world operating from our hemisphere from that spot. It was also a place where you had a narco-trafficking regime that openly cooperated with the FARC and the ELN and other drug trafficking organizations using their national territory.
Let's give Marco credit. He knows exactly what he's talking about in terms of the narcotics threat out of Venezuela, because back in the 1980s, Marco Rubio lived with his brother-in-law, Orlando Sicilia. Orlando was married to Marco's older sister, Barbara. Oh, and then I mentioned that Orlando was arrested as part of a major cocaine trafficking ring in Miami in the 1980s. And he was arrested during the time that Marco was living with him. So Marco saw firsthand narcotics trafficking going on. I mean, the hypocrisy of these people is despicable. You know, they're manufacturing this lie that Maduro was this major narcotics trafficker, particularly with fentanyl. We got to go after him because he's causing deaths with fentanyl. Yet, according to the State Department's INCSR, the International Narcotics Country Reports, the INSCR is its acronym, 99% of the fentanyl that's been seized over the last 10 years has been seized at the border with Mexico, not the border with Canada. 99%. And certainly, yeah.
99%. I did not know it was that high.
Yeah, it was that high. So well, I looked it up because I was looking it up because I was talking to somebody who was suggesting that the bigger percentage was coming through Canada. But no, it turns out it's almost entirely through Mexico. So this, oh, they're close to Russia. So Russia's not doing anything to attack us. We're the ones attacking Russia. We're the ones sponsoring terrorist attacks in Russia, for God's sake. And again, this notion with Iran sponsoring Hezbollah, please. Hezbollah didn't emerge until 1982. There are a number, what they're talking about are Shia Muslim merchants that are throughout Central and South America. And you've got, most of them are Shia, but a few of them are Sunni. And the Sunnis and Shia, they cooperate economically, but religiously, they're polar opposite poles. And so they manufacture this massive terrorist threat from Hezbollah that, you know, they've the only attack where they were implicated was the attack on the Israeli embassy and cultural center in Buenos Aires back in, I think the first one was 92, second one was 94. That's been about it. So it's not like, you know, they're carrying out a terrorist attack every other week. But again, it's part of the lies.
Is there any legal justification, is there any moral justification to say, okay, our hemisphere, our half of the world, we can decide, me being Washington, D.C., we can decide who can live there, who cannot, what the rules are, and if anybody, I don't know, say Venezuela, for a hypothetical example, says that we're going to do business with somebody from China, we're going to do business from Russia, we're going to do business from Iran, or even North Korea, for that matter. Any of those countries, is there anything that can legally, rationally, morally authorize us to step in with lethal military force to prevent it?
No. This is completely immoral. This is the behavior of an imperialist, which is what we have become. Look, the truth of the matter, why did we go into Venezuela? To make money for Paul Singer. Paul Singer, a billionaire who is a major donor, contributor to Donald Trump's campaign. Singer owns three refineries. These oil refineries that are down along the Gulf Coast. You know, we used to call it Gulf of Mexico. Now it's Gulf of America. Those refineries are specially set up to process and refine the Venezuelan oil. Venezuelan oil, you know, it's not like the oil that comes out of the ground in Permian, Texas. That comes out like a cup of coffee, you know, black crude, but you can, you know, suck it up through the ground pretty easily. Now, the stuff that comes out of Venezuela is like a half a cup of coffee mixed with peanut butter, a lot thicker, and it requires an additional $15 to $20 per barrel to refine. And, gee, when you add up 700,000 barrels of oil getting refined at Paul Singer's refineries, it's going to make Paul Singer a cool $4 billion a year. That's why we did this. Pay off Paul Singer. There was no U.S. national interest involved at all.
Well, that's not quite the same story that we're hearing out of the administration or out of the Secretary of State. As a matter of fact, he went on right after saying what the objectives were and why it was so important for us to go in. He then lays out that it's really all about democracy, Larry.
The end state here is we want to reach a phase of transition where we are left with a friendly, stable, prosperous Venezuela and democratic, in which all elements of society are represented in free and fair elections. We're not going to get there in 3 weeks. It's going to take some time. And so objective number one was stability. In the aftermath of the removal of Maduro, the concern was what happens in Venezuela? Is there civil war? Do the different factions start going at each other? Are a million people crossing the border into Colombia? All of that has been avoided. And one of the primary ways that it has been avoided is the ability to establish direct, honest conversations with the people who today control the elements of that nation, meaning the law enforcement, the government apparatus, etc. And one of the tools that's available to us is the fact that we have sanctions on oil. There is oil that is sanctioned that cannot move from Venezuela because of our quarantine.
It's all about the people, Larry. That's what you need to understand. We want to have a fair and honest conversation with the people that we are saying, do what we say or we will kill you,
yeah,
just like we kill these other people or grab you and take you into prison. That's all we're saying. We're just good guys here. How do you read that?
Yeah, I read it exactly that way. We're using force, coercion, threats, and violence to get our way. This isn't about respecting the will of the people of Venezuela. I mean, look, the reality was Hugo Chavez, as much as we disliked him, and one of the reasons we disliked him was he nationalized oil companies that belonged to us or belonged to the campaign contributors to U.S. presidents. Well, then they became enemy number one, but Hugo Chavez was popularly elected. That's called democracy. Now, there's controversy surrounding Maduro and his succession to Chavez. And I think what we can see in this inside operation that was allowing Maduro to be arrested and taken out, abducted, kidnapped, taken out of the country, would imply that at least within a significant portion of what is now the elite establishment in Venezuela, they didn't like Maduro. Now that he's out of the way, institutionally, even the major political institutions that were in place under Maduro, they're still there. And the United States is kidding itself if it thinks it's going to control. We didn't put troops in for a very good reason, because there would be a civil war, and we would have casualties.
Yeah, I remember you were telling us, warning us about that for the ever since this first came up as a possibility, and we pulled the map out, and you talked about the route from the coast up to the capital and how it had all these ambush places, et cetera, whatever. Obviously, SOUTHCOM also looked at the map, and they said, you know, that's not a good idea. Let's don't do that. Let's just throw a bunch of missiles in there and steal the guy. How about that? So that's good so far, but now then, the next thing I want to show Rubio talking about here is that he's saying that after 4 weeks, the operation has gone far better than we could have imagined.
I am saying that in 3.5, almost 4 weeks, we are much further along on this project than we thought we would be given the complexities of it going into it. And I recognize that it won't be easy. I mean, look, at the end of the day, we are dealing with people over there that have spent most of their lives living in a gangster paradise. So it's not going to be like from one day to the next, we're going to have this thing turn around overnight. But I think we're making good and decent progress. It is the best plan, and we are certainly better off today in Venezuela than we were 4 weeks ago. And I think and hope and expect that we'll be better off in 3 months and 6 months and 9 months than we would have been had Maduro still been there.
And it just sounds like to me that he is just telling everybody there with a straight face, hardly doctoring much of this up, that we're going to use the country of Venezuela for our personal oil pump, and financial capability and will decide how much, if any, of their money they actually get. But as long as they cooperate, they won't get killed. And by the way, it's going so much better than we thought. Do you think that that's an accurate assessment?
No. Look, let's deal with the oil thing. The total amount of the oil that is produced right now in Venezuela is 700, maybe 800,000 barrels a day. That represents less than 2% of total global oil production by both OPEC and non-OPEC countries. If you think less than 2% of volume of oil is going to change anything, and on top of it, it is oil that is more expensive to produce. So let's say that all oil that's pumped out of the ground is pumped out at $40 a barrel. It costs an additional $15 to $20 per barrel for Venezuelan oil. So it's going to start off more expensive, requires a lot more effort to refine it. What we haven't seen, or I guess what Narco Marco is refusing to say, is that the CIA has had a penetration of Venezuelan assets for years. I mean, going back to the days of Carlos Andres Perez, who was the president before Hugo Chavez, Perez was a CIA asset. And so they've continued to have contacts both in military and the intelligence, the two different intelligence services that are in Venezuela. So it's no surprise. And there are always people that disliked Chavez and disliked Maduro. We've been able to exploit that weakness, but there's a difference between exploiting that and being able to actually now go in and control. We still have our embassy. The Venezuelan embassy for the United States is still located in Colombia next door. Why? Because it's too damn dangerous to put Americans back in there.
Well, that does not augur well for the future. But I got a separate question before I even move on to the next thing that Rubio tried to sell us. And that is, he made comment there that things are going better after 4 weeks, at least according to his interpretation of things. And he talked about how the regime is, the people that were left behind are working with us. You made mention of the fact that there was a strong insider component to this, which facilitated the whole thing. And some people in Venezuela are very happy to be rid of Maduro, but they just exchanged one, correct me if I'm wrong, but one corrupt official for a different corrupt official. And so now somebody else is there. Do you see... Or better question, to what difficulty do you see will the Trump administration have going forward to manage this situation, we'll say, if the people inside of Venezuela say, I still want to make a lot of money here, and if I'm not going to facilitate making myself poor so that you can keep raping all the money from what little oil we do produce, or do you see them trying to gum up the works a little bit and trying to drag their feet without responding or drawing a response?
Well, there are different groups. There's not one. It's not a monolith in Venezuela. And I'm not sure at this point to what extent the CIA has been able to co-opt one of those factions. And the key is always, if you've got a faction that you're controlling, are they in a position to actually control events and exercise dominant influence? I think the answer to that right now is no. And so, we've in watching how North Americans, the U.S. officials deal with both Central and South Americans over the year, there's very much a paternalistic arrogance about it. You know, we like pat them on the head, nice little brown people, and underestimate them repeatedly. And yet, in my experience, the folks down there are pretty clever. They're very smart, and they figure out how to run circles around us.
And, right. That's kind of what I was thinking, because it just human nature, even without knowing what they're like down there. It's human nature that if someone's coming and trying to steal all of your revenue, and yet they don't put an occupying army in the place here, that you have plenty of opportunity to smile as you're moving stuff around behind the scenes there so that you don't have as much to lose. Or so it just doesn't seem like this is going to run smooth very long.
Yeah, the key question is who inside Venezuela is the one that controls the oil? Is it PDVSA, PDVSA, is there a particular individual or one particular family? And then if that's the family, then that's who the United States is going to work with. And so it depends on that family, how well they're able to pay off other people to protect and preserve their position. I mean, this is, you know, this is how organized crime works. We just keep replacing one criminal with another criminal when we ourselves are the criminals.
So let me ask you a more fundamental question along those lines. In normal interstate affairs, you can have a good cooperative relationship with not even necessarily adversaries or not even necessarily friends, but with normal states. If that's a term, I'll just use that for now, but just a state, and that we want to have good relations with this state. There's some things that we can benefit from it, so we'll do trade, whatever the course is. And so we'll have something that has some version of a win-win so that we can get something. And it can last for decades in some cases, as long as the conditions, as long as both sides still benefit from it. Do you see this situation being able to maintain this win-lose dynamic to where these guys are put in charge as long as I pat them on the head and they do what they're told, and as they keep sending most of the revenue this way, can that be sustained?
No. And let's understand that the history of U.S. relations with Mexico, Central America, South America has been one of dominance, military, political, economic dominance, for at least going back to 1846 at the start of the Mexican-American War, when we invaded Mexico and took territory from Mexico that then created New Mexico, Arizona, California as U.S. territory, and Texas as well. So, you know, we've been doing the raping and pillaging of Central South America for almost 200 years. So we're not going to change. The only thing that changes is we have a short attention span when it comes to these countries. I mean, back when I was at the CIA and I was the Honduran analyst, my God, it was one of the top five foreign policy priorities for then President Ronald Reagan and later George H.W. Bush. I mean, I was writing for the Presidential Daily Brief twice a week at least. So it was a lot of attention. And then after 1990, we couldn't find Honduras on a map, you know?
Yeah.
So, and before, you know, Honduras could, you know, they'd have some pressure with us. You know, they could shake us down for more cash because we had a vested interest in keeping a CIA bases intact. But, you know, once they were no longer necessary, once the war with in both Salvador and Nicaragua died down, yeah, they could threaten us with whatever. And we said, we don't care. You know, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah, that is the issue, is that until we don't need you anymore, and it can languish along for a long time there, and it usually doesn't end up doing anybody any good. This particular case, Rubio said a second ago that, you know, after 4 weeks it's going to be good, but he hopes that after 4 months or 6 months and on into the future, things would be continuing to get better. But if they don't, he also said the stick is still on the table.
I can tell you right now with full certainty, we are not postured to, nor do we intend or expect to have to take any military action in Venezuela at any time. The only military presence you'll see in Venezuela is our Marine guards at an embassy. But that said, if an Iranian drone factory pops up and threatens our forces in the region, the president retains the option to eliminate that threat.
I'm asking a more specific question. Do you agree that you have to come to Congress to get authorization if you are simply using force to try to compel cooperation?
Well, there's two things. There's the
It seems like
under the War Powers Act. No, under the War Powers Act, if we're going to be involved in something that's going to put us in there involved in a sustained way, we have to notify you within 48 hours after the fact. And then if it's going to last longer than 60 days, we have to come to Congress with it. We don't anticipate either of these things having to happen. Everything is moving in a very different trajectory right now. On the other hand, if we tell them we don't want to see drones from Iran, as an example, pointed at the United States or threatening our forces or our presence in the region or our allies' presence in the region, and they refuse to comply with that, the president does reserve the option in self-defense to eliminate that threat. We don't see that. We don't anticipate it. But it could happen. But we hope not. We don't want it to happen.
I'm sorry, Larry, but it absolutely drives me crazy when I hear people say that, and especially U.S. senators let it pass without comment, when Rubio says, oh, we can do whatever we want for 60 days, and then we have to notify Congress. No, that's not what the War Powers Act said. It says you can't even use them unless there's been first a congressional declaration of war, a congressional authorization, or you've been attacked. That's it. The list is only three, and it stops right there. This 60-day requirement says if, after they've been used, there's additional reporting requirements. That has been perverted and flipped up to become almost gospel to mean something it doesn't even mean at a cursory reading. And yet here's a U.S. senator, a political opponent, who left that. I mean, that's like a T-ball, man. You could have hit a home run, and you just left it sitting on the plate. I don't understand why they do that. But the bigger issue here, sorry for venting for a minute.
No, though.
The bigger issue here at the end of that clip there where he says, listen, if we need to attack in self-defense, we're going to inform you of it after the fact. What I hear there, you tell me, I'm obviously pretty aggravated here, so maybe I'm hearing extra things or not hearing others. But it sounds to me like he's saying we will use military force when and where and however damn well we play like it, and you'll say nothing except you'll pay the bills. How do you hear it?
I hear it exactly the same way. And it, they always trot out this lie that you know, Iran wants to attack us. The history of U.S.-Iranian relations, starting with you know, the U.S. attacking Iran in the 1953 with the overthrow of Mossadegh, is that it is the United States that encouraged Saddam Hussein of Iraq to start the war to attack Iran. And then we supplied him with precursor chemicals that were used to manufacture mustard gas. Now, we make a big deal about Iran support as for proxies like Hamas and Hezbollah, how many people they killed. Well, the reality is Hamas and Hezbollah over since 1982 are responsible for the deaths of a maximum 5,000 Israeli civilians. However, the United States, by use of its proxy with Iraq, killed 500,000 Iranians, a half a million. Indeed, we wonder why they chant death to America. You know, the blood that the United States has on its hands of Iranians and of Shia throughout the region. Again, they go back, yeah, but Iran was behind the bombing of the Marines barracks in October 1983. Yeah, what did we do in September of 1983? Oh, yeah, that'd be, or we had a couple of battleships over there that were throwing these monster shells into the Bekaa Valley, killing Shia men, women, and children. That's why they retaliated. But now we push this crap, these lies out of people like Rubio. It's disgusting.